Live from the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences at Michigan State University, it is now time to go beyond the X's and the O's with WKAR's Current Sports.
You want to go after an athlete, one of my athletes, come after me. I'm a man. I'm 40.
My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a star receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get.
Yes, did I express to them I was mad? I was furious. Just furious.
I know my wife will at least shot fake one time.
We talking about practice, not a game.
And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cat.
Here's your host, L. Martin.
Beautiful people, welcome to this Thursday edition of WKAR's Current Sports. It is September 24th, 2020, and I am so glad you have allowed me to be a part of your Thursday afternoon. We've got a lot to get to on today's Current Sports. You know, each and every Thursday throughout the coronavirus pandemic, you know, since I've been doing this show from home, you know, many of you have really been enjoying the Throwback Thursday episodes, as each and every Thursday we take a trip into our Current Sports time machine to take a look back at some of the best current sports shows in our history. And, you know, it's just kind of fun because it allows you to kind of like mentally trick your mind a bit that, okay, we're in a different time here. We're not going through what is arguably the worst year of all of our lives. and we're talking about sports and other subjects during a time that was normal, right? So today we are going to do that, and I'm going to roll in actually an episode of Current Sports that we not only aired on our radio airwaves, but we also put together a video feature online on our Facebook page that actually gave me my fourth Emmy nomination. How cool is that? It's a sit-down that I did with one of the most powerful voices in sports media today. She is a Michigan State alum who worked at the mothership, that is ESPN, for many, many years. And then, you know, has built up such a following that she was able to leave there and, you know, produce her own podcast. And now she has a show on Vice with also a former ESPN broadcasting personality and Kerry Champion. Folks, I'm talking about the great Jemele Hill, the one, the only Jemele Hill, who is never afraid to bite her tongue. And, you know, I thought it was fitting for today's Throwback Thursday to play her interview, that sit-down that I had with her. Oh, boy, what was that? Yeah, that had to be last year. That was last summer, actually, when I sat down with Jemele. Just because of the topics that we discussed and how timely they are. You know, I know there are so many out there in the sports world who just shook their head in disbelief of the Breonna Taylor ruling, which really, you know, Breonna Taylor received no justice, right? And that has led to riots and protesting happening across our nation, much of what we've seen this year after what happened to James Blake, after what happened in the killing of George Floyd, which really sparked all of this. But, you know, just another example of racial injustice, in my opinion. And, you know, Jemele Hill is one of those voices who is never afraid to let her voice be heard on those kind of topics. But we'll take a look at that interview. She'll talk about her time at ESPN, what led to her chucking up the deuces. to ESPN, and you know she'll dive into the shut up and dribble culture that some people want from their athletes. Many people, I'm sure, some listening to me right now, don't want to hear from their athletes unless it has anything to do with the X's and the O's, unless it has anything to do with scoring touchdowns or putting the ball through the basket, right? But those days are really over now. It's a new day in the sporting world, and we are seeing athletes use their platforms to voice what they believe in. Not mad at that. Not mad at that at all, folks. So we'll have that chat with Jemele Hill coming your way throughout this hour. But first, you know what's next. Here are your current sports quick hit headliners. Again, for this, September 24th. And we start here. We've got the latest update concerning Michigan State Athletics coronavirus testing. There was a slight downturn in the percentage of Michigan State athletes that tested positive for COVID-19. In the latest round of testing conducted by the school, the athletic department reported on Wednesday that 30 student athletes and two staff members tested positive for COVID-19 between September 15th and the 21st. Out of 369 overall tests, 328 athletes, 41 staff members. That comes to a positivity rate of 8.6% between September 7th and September 14th. The positive rate was around 12%, with 45 MSU athletes testing positive. The results were not broken down by sport, and since the beginning of June, fall sports athletes have been allowed to practice on campus since June 15th. Michigan State has conducted more than 2,320 tests on student athletes and staff members, with 123 positive results for players and 8 for staff members. So, again, the number is slightly down for Michigan State, but again, one positive test is too many. That is still a lot. 30 student athletes testing positive. All right, to the Detroit Tigers, shall we? The Detroit Tigers began this month above 500 and in the thick of the playoff race, really, right? And a little over 3 weeks later now, well, let's just say things have changed, right? As they were officially eliminated from contention last night after being swept by the Minnesota Twins and falling to 22-32 on the year, as the Tigers begin a 4-game series in Kansas City against the Royals today. They are only 2 points of really suspense remaining. Just 2 points. Will they have to play 2 makeup games against the St. Louis Cardinals on Monday in Detroit? And what will the draft position for the Tigers be in 2021? Those, again, are really the only 2 points of suspense remaining for this team. The Tigers had hoped to know the answer to the first question by now, but the National League race is providing a difficult scenario to predict. In contrast, 6 of the 8 AL playoff teams have already clinched spots, and 2 others are on the verge of doing so. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens with the Detroit Tigers. All right, Kenny Golladay practice Wednesday for the first time since injuring his hamstring on September 9th, and the Detroit Lions number one receiver could make his season debut on Sunday against the Arizona Cardinals. Now, with Golladay out of the lineup, the Lions offense has sputtered through 2 games, scoring just 44 points in losses at the hands of the Chicago Bears in week 1 and the Green Bay Packers in week 2. Golladay actually led the NFL with 11 touchdown catches last season and ranked among the league leaders at 18.3 yards per catch. He was fantastic. His absence is a big reason why the Lions' deep passing attack has been mostly non-existent during their 0-2 start. Through 2 weeks, Matthew Stafford, check this, he's completed just 2 of 8 passes that have traveled more than 20 yards downfield. That's it. And his average yards per pass attempt has fallen from a career high of 8.6 yards last year to now 7.2. Yeah, that's really, really interesting, right? So Matthew Stafford isn't chucking it down the field, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, yeah, he doesn't trust his receivers, and he does not have Kenny Galladay. All right, and I also want to note that, yes, we do have NFL action tonight. It is Thursday Night Football starting at 8:20 p.m. You can catch the 0-2 Miami Dolphins. They will be in Jacksonville taking on the 1-1 Jacksonville Jaguars. So all of you fantasy owners out there, be sure to check your rosters and plan accordingly. And also, tonight, you can catch L.A. and Denver, the NBA Western Conference Finals. The Lakers and the Nuggets getting it on as L.A. tries to rebound and try and give the Nuggets a stiff arm after that thrilling victory over the Lakers in what was Game 3. So we got Game 4 tonight, and really I think this series should be tied up. I mean, if it wasn't for an Anthony Davis heroic three-pointer on the left wing, well, we'd be staring at a 2-2 series. The Nuggets, they just don't go away, do they? Also want to note that we saw in the Stanley Cup final last night, the Tampa Bay Lightning beat the Dallas Stars 5-2. All right, 5-2 the final there, as Tampa Bay now leads that series 2-1. All right? All right, so that will do it for your current sports quick hit headliners. If you would like to be a part of the show, and again, I know that we're going to be throwing it back to a chat that I had with Jamel Hill in just a moment, but again, you can still weigh in, and you may not be able to call in live, but you can always, always, always just leave us a voice message at 517-355-WKAR. Again, that's 517-355-9527. A few of you have already done that, and I thank you because I love hearing from you guys in the midst of this crazy year that is 2020. You can also weigh in by hitting us up on Facebook.com/WKAR News. Leave us a comment there anywhere on our Facebook page. And of course, you can tweet us, tweet me directly at Al Martin WKAR, or tweet the show at WKAR News. All right, so let's hit our first break. When we come back, we will throw it back to a chat that I had with the great Jamel Hill. You are listening to the Thursday edition of WKAR's Current Sports. All right, welcome back to WKAR's Current Sports. I am your host, Al Martin. And, you know, we are living in such a wild time, right? I mean, our country in the midst of a pandemic right now. We've got so many people who have lost jobs and are living with a lot of uncertainty. Unemployment rates at an all-time high. Small business owners having to shut down permanently. It's pretty wild. It really is pretty wild right now. And not to mention all of the social unrest that is now taking place in our country. And look, here at WKAR's Current Sports, we have never and never will shy away from those kind of conversations. Because look, I just can't. Having this platform as an African-American male. What's that old saying from Uncle Ben from the Spider-Man series? With great power comes great responsibility. So the platform that I have, I will use it to have these kind of conversations. And frankly, look, they're happening all the time in the sports world. You can't separate the two anymore. You just can't. So many athletes are using their platforms to try and spark social change. And when the ruling of Breonna Taylor occurred yesterday, it, of course, sparked much outrage, which led to many big-time names in the world of sports. Which led to them to speak out. And a really interesting article from Dave McMenamine and Malika Andrews of ESPN. I just want to read the first few grabs here before I get to this throwback chat with Jemele Hill. In the Los Angeles Lakers mill room, located down the hall from the court, the team practiced on Wednesday. The television had been left on. The news anchor was dissecting a Kentucky grand jury's decision not to prosecute any of the officers involved in the death of Breonna Taylor. In the ballroom turned practice facility around the corner, the Lakers were finishing up the day's workout. LeBron James, sitting off to the side of the court eating a sandwich, discussed the decision with longtime friend Randy Mims and shook his head. Lakers players planning for a light practice after they lost Game 3 of the Western Conference Finals to the Denver Nuggets on Tuesday had their phones pinged by James earlier that afternoon, prepping them for the news. Lakers guard Danny Green said, "Bron texted the group chat that there might be an announcement made. Nobody was really happy about it. It was disappointing. In a sense, something was done, but it wasn't enough. Most guys felt it was definitely not enough. It's a tough one. James, who did not speak to reporters following Wednesday's practice, later tweeted that he has been lost for words today, tweeting, quote, "I'm devastated, hurt, sad, mad. We want justice for Breonna, yet justice was met for her neighbor's apartment walls and not her beautiful life. Was I surprised at the verdict? Absolutely not, but dang, I was and still am hurt and heavy-hearted. I send my love to Breonna's mother, family, and friends. I'm sorry. So much outrage coming from many different athletes with major voices, probably none bigger than LeBron James, of course, but so many speaking out about this. So many speaking out about what happened to James Blake. So many speaking out about the killing of George Floyd. And as this continues to happen, where you have no justice, well, guess what? There will be no peace. Someone who always keeps it real is the great Jemele Hill. I'm going to roll in now my throwback chat with Jemele Hill, MSU alum, renowned broadcaster, renowned personality, formerly of ESPN, now with her own podcast on Spotify and her own show with former ESPN personality Kerry Champion. We start here with Jemele on why she decided to leave ESPN.
Probably when I made the decision to leave SportsCenter, which I know a lot of people thought I was crazy to do. It's one of the premier jobs in sports to host the 6 o'clock SportsCenter. But for me, it was not a great experience for a lot of different reasons. And it wasn't my calling. I didn't feel like I was in the right place. And so once I made the decision to leave and I told, my bosses that I really wasn't happy, then I started to really kind of come to terms with the fact that, you know, my time at ESPN might be coming to an end. Did I expect it to happen just, you know, sort of a few months later in less than 6 months? No, but I was definitely getting that sense and that feeling that this was probably my last contract there because I frankly, everything that I wanted to do, everything I thought about doing, I'd already done. I mean, there just didn't seem to be anything else that was really getting me excited. And so I just felt like, you know, for all the things that I had done there, all the great relationships I built, that it was just kind of time to go in a different direction.
Were you happy with the way the 6 o'clock Sports Center went, how it was produced?
No, I mean, to be honest, I wasn't. And it may sound bizarre to say, but that's really through no one's fault. We were, it was a little bit of an odd and awkward situation because we were sort of like Michael Smith, my former co-host. We were like the franchise quarterbacks that were drafted, and then the head coach and GM got fired. Mm-hmm. And they wanted us to run a different offense. And while we could run that offense, it wasn't necessarily an offense that would bring out the best in us. It's an offense that worked for that particular platform. It just didn't work for us. And so it was not the best experience. I learned a lot. I think I grew a lot. And certainly when it comes to being an anchor on TV, especially at a very fast-paced show like SportsCenter, that part of it, you know, I think I really did kind of dig down on and really learned a lot. But in terms of some of the differences that we were having behind the scenes, that was difficult to get through. I mean, I didn't think it was a belief in our lack of ability, but I think that we just had very different philosophies about how the show should be run, operated, and what the content should be.
Okay, some time has now passed since you called President Trump a white supremacist on Twitter. And, you know, interesting about that moment, Jamel, because I listened to an interview when you were on the Dan Le Batard show, and you said you were very surprised that that particular tweet went viral. You said, quote, "I thought I was just calling water wet."
Yeah.
Right. And I'm wondering that moment it went viral. You know, you had the president calling you out. Sarah Huckabee Sanders also called you out. I'm wondering if that moment has changed the way you look at media today.
You know, it hasn't, because my perception and outlook on media was already changing just by the way this presidency and this administration has been covered overall. There are just parts of journalism I just don't even recognize. And some of it has to do with the fact, and I guess in this way it does relate to my situation, is that with journalism, you have to maintain the ability to tell the truth. And I think right now there is a struggle with that because we're not really used to an administration behaving in this way. There were, even within, you know, the fierce competitiveness of politics, it was a certain decorum that was expected. And that decorum is not there. And so the media is constantly caught off guard and on their heels. You know, it could be with very simple things. Like, the president has outright lied on a number of things, facts that can be checked that are easily refutable. But when you read the headline, it says he misled, or, you know, they use every word but what it is, which is it's a lie, you know, and it's a purposeful lie. It's not one of those things where it's accidental or he just misspoke or he misremembered. No, it's just an actual lie. And so the media is having a hard time understanding how to cover this particular presidency. So for me, when I said that about him, a lot of people thought it may have came from an emotional place. It did, only in the sense that, you know, Charlottesville was relatively new. I think this country as a whole was in an emotional state. So from that standpoint, yes. But in terms of why I called him that, no, I consider that to be very fact-based. And now it's funny because it feels like these days calling the president a white supremacist is like it's lost its luster, because I feel like everybody's calling him this now. I don't want to give myself, I'm not crediting myself by saying I was the first, uh-huh. But I will say that language associated with him has become very common.
In what way did that tweet change your life, if at all?
It changed my life in a million ways. It's not just one. Yeah, obviously, I was used to being known kind of among sports fans, and even, I mean, sports fans, both diehard and casual. But then suddenly, it's a whole new group of people that have been introduced to me, and introduced to me in this way. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't in a particularly calm way, but in something that was very, you know, provocative, I guess you could say. So there are people that I meet now, or people that, you know, ask me for a picture or talk to me just because they recognize me, who don't even know what I did at ESPN. They only know me from that. And, you know, just certainly from a public profile standpoint, it's changed, you know, quite a bit. You know, again, I think there were a certain segment of people that knew me, and now there's a much wider segment of people that know me. And so I think sort of the language and how I'm described has changed. I mean, people have described me as an activist, which I appreciate the compliment, but I'm not. I am still, you know, a journalist. And so it would be hard. We'd be here another hour if I explained every way in which my life changed, but it changed dramatically.
Your time at The Atlantic, and I want to get to a piece of yours later on this interview that really caught my eye recently. But your time at The Atlantic, and I mentioned the podcast, Jemele Hill's Unbothered, that's the name of it, right? I'm wondering now, when you compare what you're able to do now at The Atlantic and with this new podcast coming, in what way has the way you look at journalism and the way you attack journalism changed in comparison to that time?
Well, the difference is, like, ESPN is a strictly a sports platform for the most part. I mean, right. There are some coloring outside the lines that occurs in terms of covering the convergence between sports and culture. But people go there for games, and they go there for live events, and they go there for analysis. And that's the expectation. At The Atlantic, it's a completely different publication. I mean, it is a political publication. Mm. I just so happen to be covering sports there, right? And covering sports in a political way, where as opposed to, I think there was a sentiment at ESPN of sticking to sports. I mean, mostly I'm talking about from the base consuming ESPN.
Right.
At The Atlantic, they expect you to stick to everything but sports, right? So I can write about sports in a much different way, looking at power dynamics, looking at, you know, power structures, looking at race, looking at gender, looking at culture. So it's different. And with the podcast, I mean, that is not a sports podcast, by the way. Will we discuss some sports? Yeah, we will. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about the unbelievable way Magic Johnson just left his job with the Lakers.
Man. Talk about shockwaves, right? Yeah, Magic dropped the mic and said, I'm out.
That was something. And for those people who have, like, quit fantasies, that's, like, one of them. Like, yeah, my boss didn't even know, but, yeah, I'm out of here, y'all. I was like, wait, what?
Right. I think Jeannie was driving to the Staples
exactly.
Center and just found out, like, yeah, I'm not going to that game
right now. It kind of reminded me of that scene in Harlem Nights where the dude calls on me. He's like, tell your mama I ain't never coming back. It just sort of right. reminded me of that. But anyway, you know, so I can cover it in a much different way. Now, with the podcast, I mean, again, that's the reason it's called Unbothered is because it will be a little unhinged, very unfiltered. Mm-hmm. I have two great co-hosts, Cole Wiley and Michael Arsenault, and we plan to talk about, you know, topics of interest that cover, you know, the gamut of news, sports, politics, pop culture. So we'll dive into a little bit of everything. So I apologize to those sports fans who think they've signed up for a sports podcast because you have not.
This will be different. I'm looking
forward
to it.
Yeah, this will be different. And on top of having, like, a lot of newsmaker interviews, because at least as a podcast consumer, what I enjoy a lot are interviews with people, because in the podcast space, it just feels much more intimate. And so I want to bring, you know, sort of that level of intimacy to people.
Colin Kaepernick. He received a settlement from the National Football League. And I want to know, Jemele, because I feel like the talk about the protest and the anthem and why Colin was doing the protest in the first place, that talk has kind of died down now. Do you feel like the athlete today, when it comes to protesting for civil rights, do you feel like that phase is over right now, or will we continue to see that maybe in a different way?
I think it is far from over, and I think Colin Kaepernick's story is far from over. Lest we forget, he still hasn't talked yet, and mm-hmm. so there's still many more chapters, I think, that need to be added on top of the work he's continuing to still do. He hasn't stopped his work in this whole process. But I feel like athletes are very activated now, not just because of Colin Kaepernick, but also because of LeBron James. I mean, he's a self-created mogul who is he's teaching other athletes a different blueprint for success, that they can control their own narrative, that they can be their own business, and, you know, that they can be their own empire. And that level of ownership, I think, is very threatening to a lot of the people that are so used to writing them a check, as opposed to them saying, I don't need your check, I can do this on my own. Or, yeah, your check is nice, but it's not going to influence, you know, what I think and how I move. So I think it's a very different sensibility these days. And the activism is showing up in different ways. I mean, you have, of course, LeBron, starting a school in Akron, all the things he's doing. But you have Antonio Brown, too. Mm-hmm. Right. And while I know people would find it weird that I would put him in that space, people have to understand in the NFL, you don't see that. You don't see players taking on an organization like the Steelers feeling as if a big reason why, because they feel like they're not getting paid for what they're worth. Le'Veon Bell doing the same thing is that they're challenging a financial structure that takes advantage of them. Mm-hmm. You know, Antonio Brown had no guaranteed money coming the next three seasons. That is part of what his complaint was in Pittsburgh. He's saying, if I am the most talented player on offense, or at least one of two, if Le'Veon, whatever way you want to slice it, then why is it that I have no guaranteed money coming the next three seasons?
Right.
And so it feels like in the football space that as you see more fully guaranteed money or more guaranteed money than you've ever seen, that they're getting ready perhaps to mount a significant challenge to that structure. So I think that right now athletes are in a really good space where they feel like they are empowered to speak their mind. Social media is part of it, too. Like, they know they can take their message directly to the people they want to speak to. I mean, I don't know if 5 years ago Kyle Korver writes the essay that he wrote for the Players Tribune about white privilege. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that happens. So I think we're seeing numerous examples about how much they feel like they want to be a part of this conversation.
We've seen many male athletes speak out against social injustice, back to the Muhammad Ali days and Jim Browns of the world, right? Lou Alcindor. I'm wondering, though, I want you to kind of, if you could, Jamel, talk about Serena Williams, because it seems like whenever Serena comes out, you know, shows some kind of aggressive take on something, it's just her. There's a backlash, an undertone that's there, right, when it comes to public perception. What do you think of Serena Williams when she does get that kind of backlash in the public?
Well, I'll say this overall about female athletes is that they have been fighting in the space to be heard, to be respected, and drawing attention to social injustice for a really long time. And even with all the things that were said about from male athletes about police brutality, it was the women that led them there, because it was the Minnesota Lynx and the WNBA players. They started that, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
And so when Philando Castile was killed, like, they started a lot of that conversation. Fast forward to Serena, who, much like a lot of athletes, especially after they've been able to achieve some things, we've seen her come into her own right before our eyes. Her and Venus are a big reason why there's equal prize. I mean, they are the reason why there's equal prize money at Wimbledon. Tennis is the closest we have come to seeing sort of male and female athletes treated equally, mm-hmm. In the same sport.
Right, right.
And a lot of that has to do with the Williams sisters and the fact that because of them, women's tennis has been a significantly bigger draw in terms of interest, in terms of a lot of different things, you know, in this country. It's like, you know, Serena and Venus have dominated this sport for basically 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I think because of her willingness to take on these fights, her willingness to speak out against police brutality, which she also did, and talking about how she, I think it was her nephew, how she became uncomfortable with him driving her car because of everything that she was seeing that was happening. The reaction to Serena is really no different than the reaction that we've seen whenever people of color have dared to publicly challenge a system. It is going to make people uncomfortable, and it's going to draw backlash. You know, a lot of people just want athletes, especially black athletes, to be here purely for their entertainment. They don't want to hear about what it's like to actually live the black experience, or they want to pretend they don't live the black experience just because they're famous and they have money, when it's completely the opposite. And so for her to always be willing to kind of put herself to some degree on that firing squad, I think it just speaks to her maturity and just her growth and her willingness to be a role model and to be bigger than just being Serena Williams, greatest female tennis player of all time. She wants to be a great ambassador. She wants to be a great leader. She's now a mother. And without her, I don't know if there's enough, or there would have been this much awareness about the struggles of Black women when it comes to the mortality rate with pregnancy. She almost died. Yeah. And it turns out that's a significant problem in this country that is not at all limited by income status. It is happening across all income levels in all regions, that Black women are dying at a rate of childbirth that in childbirth at a rate that they had not seen since the 1850s. And that's scary to contemplate, but we would not know that had she not given voice to that and what she was going through. So I think she's incredible. And whether she ties or surpasses Margaret Court, who has, you know, the most slams, or not, to me, she's still going to be the greatest female tennis player ever.
All right, more with Jamel when we come back. You are listening to this Throwback Thursday edition of WKAR's Current Sports. Mel, I want to bring it home now and discuss, without a doubt, what has been the darkest chapter in this university's history.
Yeah.
Right? The Larry Nassar scandal. Mm-hmm. Also last year, that was coupled with the ESPN report from Paula Levine that targeted the Michigan State men's basketball team and football team. I want to know what you made of the public scrutiny that this university got. And was it justified?
It was absolutely justified. I mean, Larry Nassar doesn't happen in a vacuum. There was leadership fails at every level, which, I mean, I think everybody knows and it's pretty obvious what those leadership fails were. Independent of that, you know, there were some questions that were posed about how our two biggest sports, you know, football and basketball, how they have handled sexual assault allegations. And I know it was difficult because of how highly people think of Tom Izzo and Mark D'Antonio. I think very highly of them, too. But I also think that there's an added responsibility to both of them because they're the face of this university. Tom Izzo, in particular, is the face of Michigan State. And so when the questions began about his program, I thought he should answer them and explain to people why certain decisions were made.
You wrote a piece in the Undefeated about that, right?
I did. Yeah. And it did not win me any friends around here, that's for sure. Mm. And
Did you get any calls from Izzo or anybody?
No, Izzo and I were fine. But there were some other people in the basketball program that definitely took issue with what I said. And, you know, I never called for him to be fired. I never said anything like that. But when you're the face, is these questions are asked. Now, what I will say, and I thought this was sort of unfair at ESPN, and I understood why people here were very upset. The link, people tried to draw a linkage between Larry Nassar, Mark D'Antonio, and Tom Izzo.
The graphic.
The graphic.
Yeah.
That wasn't responsible. And I say that, you know, as somebody who, you know, obviously worked at ESPN for as long as I did, really trust the majority of news decisions that were there. But optically, I don't think anybody took a step back to really understand what that looked like, because it looked like they were related and they weren't.
Right.
And I do understand taking a look at how programs in general here handle sexual assault. That was totally, to me, within bounds, but that graphic understandably left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. So that, I thought the anger here about that was very justified, because it made it seem like Izzo and D'Antonio were somehow condoning or conspiring with Larry Nassar, and they were not related at all. But, you know, yeah, I mean, that can be the difficult role that you have as a journalist. It's like I had thought I long left my days of having to cover Michigan State, and I obviously had established some friendships here. And, I wrote the piece for The Undefeated, and, I'll be frank, I don't know if some relationships will be the same because of that. And I'm okay with that because I felt like I could not credibly or justifiably, have a platform and act as if everything was okay here, because it wasn't. And
right.
I don't think it's any shame in peeling back the layers. And even if it hurts a little bit, you're going to grow from the hurt. But I've also been very adamant about the fact, as I told you know, students I've talked to since, and even the students I spoke to last year when I was here, is that regardless of Larry Nassar, look, he's not going to make me feel ashamed about my degree here or about the time I spent here. I met some of my best friends here. I grew as a person here. I grew as a journalist here. Larry Nassar isn't going to have that kind of power over me, and they shouldn't let him have that kind of power over them either. There is nothing about what you have done here. If you've gone to this university, you're proud of it. You've achieved and accomplished something here. Larry Nassar has nothing to do with you, and you should feel proud, you know, to wear the green and white and to be proud that you went to this university.
The ESPYs last year, of course, had the survivors, a few of the survivors of Larry Nassar, many of the survivors of Larry Nassar, honored with the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. I'm curious, Jamel, when you saw that scene of all of them coming out of the aisles and standing together, very powerful scene. What went through your mind when you saw that?
I was as struck by not just the power, but the strength and the courage of these women who have been through unimaginable things, unspeakable things, horrors most of us will never know. And for them to have collectively been able to come together, create their own network, create their own support system, I thought was really remarkable. And one thing I could just say in general, that in terms of Michigan State's response, the students, the community to the survivors was really incredible. And I always got the sense that people here, they weren't content with letting things be swept under the rug. They wanted to make sure that they were here for the people who were most victimized by these heinous acts. And so I thought it was a really, powerful moment. I thought it was one of the best sports moments of 2018.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. All right, I got two more for you. I want to go here because this is so fresh. You know, this death has even affected me in ways that I didn't see coming. Mm-hmm. But the passing of famed hip-hop artist Nipsey Hussle, it sent shockwaves throughout the Black community. You wrote a very compelling piece in The Atlantic that really shot down the conspiracy theorists that are still out there coming up with different conspiracies as to why Nipsey Hussle died and so on and so forth. But I want you to talk about why this death has meant so much, has impacted us so much in the Black community, and also what is the truth about Nipsey Hussle's passing?
So I think the reason it struck a chord, some of us are old enough to have lived through similar deaths, unfortunately. I mean, I was a student here when Biggie and Tupac were killed. And I think for all of us, it strikes a chord when we see a young Black man, and I realize he was 33, but that's still young to me.
Very young. Yeah.
You know, coming into his own, growing, doing a lot of amazing things for his community right where he grew up at, because this is not to shame those people, but plenty of us come from certain neighborhoods. You know, we move on and we never look back. And a lot of it is because there is a level of fear about what happens when you return.
Have you had that thought in Detroit? You know,
no, I mean, you know, I have always been of the mindset that whatever I can, I'm going to give to Detroit. You know, I don't live there anymore. I still have family that lives there. But it's important to me to see Detroit thrive. And so I do what I can to make sure that that's a reality, because I remember who I was coming up in the city and what it meant when, you know, certain outreach programs. I mean, that's the whole reason why I became a journalist.
Right.
Is because a few different outreach programs that I was a part of in Detroit. So I want to make sure that others that come behind me have those same opportunities. So I very much understood Nipsey Hussle's mindset from that standpoint. And so, you know, he kind of represented this tragic tale that we just hear about in our community way too much, about young Black men having their lives shortened before they fully reach their potential. They're on the right path. They're right there. You can see where, that's why Victory Lap is such a poignant title of his album, because he was in that mold.
Right.
You know, he'd been Grammy nominated after years of being on the mixtape circuit and becoming, you know, a bit of a cult hero. Finally, this was his big moment, and to have his life taken away, and the way it was taken away, it's just hard to fathom. And I think that's why a lot of the conspiracy theory started. It was out of hurt because a lot of us don't want to recognize, or at least we don't want to come to grips with the violence that happens in our community. You know, this is not me getting on some soapbox, coming out with, you know, coming off the top rope with some, you know, black on black crime, you know, lecture, because it's way more complicated than that. It is about the fact that, you know, we have been brutalized by violence as a people for hundreds of years. And a lot of times those, that brutalization that you experience, you take it and you brutalize other people. You take on the same traits that were used to oppress you. You know, it's that old adage about that, is that the oppressed begin to take on traits of the oppressor. And so for a lot of reasons, lack of resources, lack of jobs, lack of education, you know, there's a ton of reasons why this violence takes place. But nevertheless, it is there. And it was a old adage I think I put in the column, which is, you know, everybody in your circle is not in your corner. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for Nipsey Hussle, the way it looks now from what we know about the person, you know, that is suspected of killing him, is that there was some beef between them. And, you know, him being back in the neighborhood, as great as it was to see him do it, and as good as it was to know that he cared about them and wanted to financially empower that area, you better believe there was people there that didn't want to see it. People that were jealous of it. People that were jealous of him and the respect that he commanded. Unfortunately, it's a common story. The difference is that this is somebody who was famous, who was a rapper, who a lot of people loved and a lot of people knew. But this happens so many times in communities of color, or in the black community, I should say, in particular, that that I think is the part that hurts people the most, is that, you know, we thought we had reached a point where at least there was some level of protection for certain people. That's not to say that their life meant more than anybody else's, mm-hmm. but it is to say somebody like this who was doing the things that he was doing should have been protected, should have been one like protect at all costs. And that wasn't the case.
It certainly was not. OK, Jamel, last question for you. I'm you know, when you reflect on where you are now and in the journey that you've had, how are you dealing with the weight now of being a leader and an influencer that is known nationally here in America?
Well, I guess I deal with it because I don't really think about it that often.
You're not up at night like saying, oh, man, this is
no, I don't,
a lot of pressure.
I don't wake up every morning saying, hey, I'm an influencer. Like, I just don't do that. I just try to be me. And, right. You know, that's really all I know how to do is be myself.
Right.
And so all people are seeing from me is that, you know, I've been the same person forever. It's just that more people hear it now because of the platform I've been able to create and establish. But, you know, I think like a lot of people, with what I've been given, I just try to operate it with a sense of, you know, integrity, integrity in terms of my gift, integrity in terms of this platform. And I feel like, you know, if you operate that way, the rest kind of takes care of itself. And so, you know, I feel very humbled and grateful and blessed to be in this position. But it's going to be meaningless unless I use it to bring other people forward. I mean, so for me, that's kind of more the mission than this being about, you know, myself. You know, mm-hmm. I'm more excited with this podcast for people to get to know my two co-hosts than I am for myself. I mean, I love the fact of doing a podcast and doing it on Spotify and having, you know, a great, you know, kind of a great and a different sort of base, if you will, you know, music lovers. But I'm more in it to see Cole and Michael really be heard and respected.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that look back. And as you just heard, Jamel Hill is an individual who will never bite her tongue. And I'm just kind of following in her footsteps, because she is an example of high moral character and what we should all be doing. It's just a matter of right and wrong. You speak up when you see wrong. I thank Jamel for her time last year, and I hope to get her on the show soon, as she is really doing her thing now again, her own show with Carrie Champion now on Vice and her own podcast on Spotify. Give it a check. But we'll see you on the Friday edition of the show, folks. I want you guys to have a fantastic rest of your Thursday. It is a beautiful one today. Be smart, be safe, and as always, be easy, people.